and welcome to another episode of Untrue Crime, where fiction meets felonies. I'm Alex.
And I'm Belle. Today's episode includes content warnings for violent death, child abuse, religious trauma, rape, and abusive religion.
This is your fair warning that this podcast does use explicit language before someone walks in at the wrong time. As a last warning, today's episode does include violent death, child abuse, religious trauma, rape, and abusive religion. So let's get this started, shall we?
We shall.
For many people, religion is a part of their lives, be it something that they follow, something that they turn to in times of need, or something that is a difficult part of their past. People find it in different ways, lose it in different ways, and live with it in different ways. Whatever your relationship to religion, its impact on the world cannot be denied, and it is seen across the globe, whether it exists or doesn't. In Austria, 57% of the population identifies as Catholic, over half. The country boasts beautiful cathedrals, basilicas, and chapels, from the stone majesty of St. Stephen's that draw visitors from all over the world down to one-room churches with their pews of locals and their prayers. In all sizes and levels of grandeur, these are places of worship held in high regard by most Catholics who consider them to be sacred spaces, something referred to as vessels of meaning. A staple of any Catholic church is a box or cabinet in which the Eucharist, consecrated communion hosts, are housed. This means that according to the Catholic faith, in the box, which is in the church, is God, literally. This is one of the many things that make these churches considered holy spaces. The holiness of these places mean there are certain rules about what is and what is not acceptable inside a church. Things from New Age items to tobacco products are not permitted within a church. There are also rules about what you are allowed to do, as many things can be seen as disrespectful to a church, and to disrespect the church is a considerable offense to Catholics.
I like that you called the church a box.
Oh, no. The box is a physical thing in the church.
What?
Yes, so if you're Catholic...
I'm not Catholic, obviously.
I am also not Catholic, but I know a considerable amount of Catholics, surprisingly. And I've been to Mass. So they have a physical box in there in which they have the consecrated communion hosts, which is the Eucharist, which means that's where they keep their little wine and their bread, and then they bless it, and they're like, oh, okay, this is God.
Oh, I love the juice and bread. Well, wafers.
Yes, so the thing is, this is the difference between Protestantism and Catholicism. In Protestantism, it's symbolic. The wine isn't literally Jesus' blood. In Catholicism, it is believed that is literally Jesus right there. So that means that if you bless them, when the priest blesses them and they become literally Jesus in the Catholic doctrine, that means they believe that literally Jesus is in the box. So the box is important, and the box goes in the church, which makes it church important. So it's all important because it's all holding the box, which has Jesus.
Isn't the whole thing supposed to be about how God is above humankind and that humans can never summon Jesus?
Not if you're Catholic. Also, no, generally, no, actually, that's a thing in, like, when it comes to, like, exorcisms and stuff like that, or not just in Catholicism, but in Protestantism too, like, you're supposed to be able to do things in the name of God should the circumstances call for it.
Yeah, but in the name of God, not to the summoning of God.
Well, okay, so here's what, so when I was growing up, I was taught that if you ever encounter a demon trying to get you, you are a Christian and therefore you have the Spirit of God in you in a certain sense.
Oh.
Which means if you say, in the name of God, I demand you leave or something like that, and you actually believe, then Christ will kind of move through you and will get the demon out. So kind of it's like summoning Jesus.
The pastor's wife told me a story about how she encountered a demon, and she was like,
everyone must be prepared. I was like, what the fuck? I was so scared.
Everyone must be prepared for the demon.
That said, not everyone follows every rule, especially those who don't respect the church in the first place for any number of reasons. Unfortunately, for many, faith is not something that is a comfort, but rather something that they feel hostile toward because of how it may have hurt them. Many people suffer from religious traumas that continue to affect them after leaving the church or have been part of a group that has been maltreated by Christians. For others, the faith itself is not what turns them away, but rather the people that practice it. Whatever their reason, plenty of people have turned their back on Christianity, often after it has turned its back on them. That brings us to Ezra Strasser. Ezra Strasser was born to Catholic parents and was baptized as an infant in accordance with tradition. His parents, deeply devoted, taught him their religion from a young age. His experience was a little different than the average Catholic upbringing, though.
Question.
Yes.
We have not mentioned what time period we're in.
This is, like, the early 2000s when he's born, and he's, like, growing up and stuff. And it takes place in a version of our world, depending on whether or not you believe in religion.
What year?
Maybe, like, 2001? I didn't really specify. It's not super pertinent, but it is the modern age.
I just like to compare where people are in my timeline. It's important to me.
Yeah, no, when we get to the actual crime, we're in today.
Okay.
But right now, we're about like 20-ish years before that. So okay. Like, early 2000s. His parents, deeply devoted, taught him their religion from a young age. His experience was a little different than the average Catholic upbringing, though. He spent Christmases without gifts to prevent greed after he attended midnight mass, was told not to celebrate his birthday lest he become too prideful of his own being, and he was in trouble for anything his parents said was sinful, whether or not it was truly regarded as such by the church.
Do you want to hear a funny story?
Do I?
No.
Something in me tells me this story is not funny.
It's not
funny.
Please
proceed, though.
And frankly, if my ex-girlfriend ever found out I told this story, she might actually do everything in her power to reach out and contact me to tell me to take this episode down. So,
oh my god, do you want me to leave it in?
Depends on if you find it funny. So, okay. My ex-girlfriend was not Catholic, but most likely Protestant, as in like...
Christian.
Yeah, Christian, but... close to Catholic, attended mass. I had gone to her church like once or twice to
like Anglicans.
Maybe it's hard to tell.
I'm sorry, I was raised in the church and I
it's hard to tell, but she did, you know, she did all the things. She wore her dress and everything. But anyways, one time she told me a little bit too much personal detail about her life. Mm-hmm. And there were many details about her life that I wanted to know because I'm really clingy. But there are some things that I did not want to know at the ripe age of 16, 17. One of those things was when my horrible, horrible ex-girlfriend texted me, "Oh, my parents are fighting again." And I was like, "Oh no, that's no good. Go hide in your room," because, you know. And she starts telling me what they're arguing about. And she says, "I just heard my mom from across the house yell at my dad, 'Masturbation is a sin.'" And then my dad yells back, "It doesn't say so in the Bible." And
oh my god,
I heard that from her person. I was like, I did not need to know that about your father, a man that I've known throughout a significant portion of my childhood.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it all depends on how you define your body as a temple, on whether or not that's a sin. I guess it depends on your outlook on temples.
I'm so glad that someone else knows about that now. It was kind of just like a deeply hidden memory.
Okay, I'm gonna resume. I don't know where I left off, though. Oh, okay, I found where I left off. Okay. He prayed at meals. He prayed before bed. He prayed before leaving the house. It seemed that all his parents had him do was pray, and he prayed most each Sunday. His parents enrolled him in a Catholic school, and he was put in the children's choir at his church, even though it wasn't something that he enjoyed very much. Despite a strict upbringing, he wasn't a very unhappy child. Generally, his childhood wasn't so bad, even if it was more structured and lacking things other children usually experienced. He loved his parents, and he believed his parents loved him. Things got more difficult in middle school.
I was raised Christian, but I was raised Lutheran, and so... church was more laid back, where it was like, oh, all right, come together, we'll talk the good word, we'll talk about loving others, and that was pretty much a lot of what we learned. And then we learned a lot about, like, Bible study, but I went to church on Sundays, and that was pretty much it. But I remember I was in school with Catholic kids, and one of them had mentioned that they went to church on Wednesdays, and I was like, what? You go to church on Wednesdays? She's like, yeah, I go to Bible study. And I was like, that's so tragic. What? You go to school after school? And she's like, yeah.
I did that.
I was always so questioning where it was like, oh, but why? Like, I hate school. And she's like, it's fine. I don't care.
Yeah, we had to memorize verses and then recite them back.
I don't know what she did. She liked it, though.
I did not like Awana, for the record. I thought that the fun gym game time was the worst part. I actually liked the memorizing of verses because it provided me with academic validation.
Okay.
Ezra had been confirmed and had his first confession without much fuss, but when he was 13, friction began between himself and his parents, as he wanted to do things other kids did, like spend time with his friends outside of school. They all got to run around town and have sleepovers and attend summer camp. Why couldn't he?
Why couldn't he go to church camp?
Well, I don't know if he went to church camp, but he couldn't go to regular summer camp. The boiling point came when he met a girl he liked and began dating her behind his parents' back as he snuck out of the house. They found out, and Ezra's mother poured out half a bag of salt on the floor, forcing her son to kneel upon it for hours while he prayed for forgiveness. The event hardened his heart toward them, as it would anyone's. He continued to date the girl against their will, they found out once more, and Ezra became well acquainted with a literal interpretation of the first half of Proverbs 13:24, "Spare the rod, spoil the child." He became increasingly rebellious in retaliation, messing around behind their backs with various substances and doing things that not just the church, but the law would frown upon, despite avoiding arrest. It was a difficult time for him, one in which he began to doubt that his parents cared about him at all.
Was the salt to ward away demons?
No, the salt is, it's vaguely symbolic over, like, you know, pillars of salt, salt of the earth, that kind of thing. But ultimately, it's a punishment technique because if you have to kneel on it for hours, it, like, digs into your skin and it hurts really bad. And also, it kind of dries it out, and it's just really awful. In a later published biography, Ezra's cousin said that Ezra once told her that his twin sister, Esther, was his rock. She reported that he said, quote, "She was always looking out for me. If it were not for Esther, I think I would have met my parents' God far sooner," end quote. Something that stuck with her years later. Evidence of the closeness between Ezra and his twin could easily be seen. When he was 10, she gave him a cross necklace as a gift for his birthday because she figured their parents wouldn't be angry about him getting a gift on a day that wasn't supposed to have any in their eyes if it had religious imagery on it, and she was right. It was treasured by Ezra, as it was the only birthday gift he had ever gotten.
I think it's really unfortunate that biblical names are still being used, because they're so old. And they're so old-sounding.
I kind of like some of them.
I'm sorry. I'm not going to the club with a bitch named Esther.
Okay, you're so right on that, but, like, there's some that are fine, like, you know, like, James.
Esther, you want to go to a rave? No, my papa needs me home to churn the milk into butter.
Good thing the Amish can't hear this.
Shout out to the Ezras out there. Ezras and Esther.
Later in their lives, Esther did a phenomenal job of presenting herself to be exactly what their parents wanted. Quiet, chaste, and obedient. So they believed that they had succeeded with raising her right, which gave her the upper hand when she was looking out for Ezra. She could always cover for him when he wasn't around, and when she left the house stating that she was meeting with friends from school for Bible study, they didn't question it since she was their perfect daughter. Therefore, she could go find Ezra when he was in trouble, or get him anything he needed from the local grocery store after a hard night. One night, though, Esther's parents entered her room without knocking and discovered that her best friend from Bible study wasn't just a friend. Her girlfriend was made to leave, and despite Ezra's best attempts to protect his sister, she was raped by their father as a form of correction. When asked if she would choose God again, she spat in his face, so they kicked her out when she was 16. Ezra left voluntarily, telling his parents that they were the very monsters that they believed everyone else to be. Obviously, rape is illegal in Austria, but so is forcing your 16-year-old out of the house. Regardless, the parents were not found out, as the twins never went to the police. They instead told everyone that the twins were staying with a friend. In fact, they were never prosecuted for any of the crimes they committed against their children. Esther and Ezra made their way through the world as best as they could until they turned 18. Both despised their parents, but Esther hated them deeper than Ezra.
No shit.
They didn't see them for years after being kicked out, but one day, at a local store, they happened to run into one another. After a verbal confrontation, Esther went back to her parents' home that night and strangled both with electrical cords for what they had done to her.
Yes.
As she
yes.
should.
Go, Esther. Okay, maybe I do go to the club with a bitch named Esther.
Unfortunately, Esther doesn't get to the club. Police found her and arrested her. She pled guilty to the crime, saying that she'd do it again, and was sent to prison, leaving Ezra on his own.
Prison club!
Prison club! Prison rave! They can drink alcohol brewed in toilets!
Yippee!
He visited her often, but felt lost. His sister had always been with him, and despite them being the same age, he looked up to her. Her being locked away was not something he had ever anticipated having to cope with. It had been a long time since he had connected with religion, but without Esther, he didn't know what to do. One afternoon, he returned to the church he grew up in, looking for some kind of answers. He found none, only the priest, who was angry at him for showing his face after he betrayed his parents and failed to control his sister. He was going to throw a punch, but was let out by another congregation member who had known him as a child. They asked him not to come back for his own good. He hated the church. It had been used as the justification to abuse him. It was why his parents had treated him so poorly throughout his life. It was why they were thrown out. It was why Esther was raped, and now it was why she was in prison. It was supposed to be some kind of warm, guiding light, a religion preaching love, and yet after trying to come back to it for those very things and being treated with hostility, he believed then that it was a hypocritical lie used to hurt others. The same night that he spoke with his former priest, he showed up with a Molotov cocktail and sent it through the window of a different church.
Cheers.
He did the same to five other churches before coming upon the final one, the one he'd grown up in.
I want to specify that I said cheers because it was a Molotov cocktail, which I watched The Good Place, and I thought about Jason, so.
Fair enough.
Jacksonville!
Of course you would love Jason. The priest was still in his office working on his upcoming sermon. The doors were locked, so Ezra broke a stained glass window and went inside in search of the man he had spoken to earlier that day. Later, the priest testified that Ezra Strasser attacked him, confessing what he had done to the other churches as he began to strangle him with an electrical cord, just as Esther had done to their parents. He blacked out and thus did not know what happened next, but when he awoke, Ezra Strasser was gone.
Couldn't finish the job. Shameful.
He called the police immediately to report the incident, and they showed up on the scene right away. Police stated that they were investigating a series of arsons committed and asked if they matched the description of what Strasser had given him. When the priest confirmed this, they began their hunt for one man in particular. However, it seemed that Ezra Strasser was nowhere to be found. He was not with his family, he was not at his apartment, and he wasn't with any of his known associates. In fact, it was as if he had vanished off the face of the earth. There were two security cameras by the church. One showed the west-facing front of it, and one showed the southern side of the church. The south camera had seen him break into the church, but the western camera did not see him emerge from the front. There were no damaged windows on the northern side, so it was reasoned that he had to have gone out the back door to the east. What remained of Ezra Strasser was eventually discovered behind the church. The officer nearly missed it, but spotted a glint of something right at the foot of the wall of the church. All that was left of Ezra Strasser was the necklace that Esther had given him for his 10th birthday that had a cross on it, laying neatly on top of a pile of ash.
How do we know that's Ezra?
I'm so glad you asked! It should be noted that ashes cannot contain DNA evidence, and once a person has been burned, there's no telling if the ash was once a human being, a piece of paper, or a twig, but the necklace was most certainly Ezra's. Police began to operate under the assumption that those ashes were what remained of Ezra Strasser.
That's so silly, though. That's so goofy.
Let's discuss.
If anyone ever finds a pile of ash, please do not think, oh, that's Bella, even though it might have my Bond bracelet on it.
Let's discuss the theory that those ashes were once Ezra first. Why it was posited, what is plausible, and what is implausible. First, why was it considered? There was enough ash present for it to have once been Ezra's whole body, and it would have been quite the symbolic way to kill him if it was a vengeance for destroying churches, likely by someone religious. Cremation is a divisive subject in the Catholic Church, with many believing it to prevent people from entering heaven when resurrected, as Catholics believe they will be. To burn someone, in many parts of the Catholic Church, is to deny them eternal life, and even those that allow cremation have very strict rules about how the ashes are to be handled. They most certainly are not supposed to be left on the ground out back of a church, so to burn him would be symbolic. It would take away what many Catholics see as the most important thing in the world, a chance at heaven, even though Ezra had been baptized. It would also explain, perhaps, why the necklace was untouched. It preserved a symbol of Jesus, which a Catholic may have found objectionable to destroy, especially alongside someone they saw as a terrible sinner. Benny pointed to the priest, thinking he did something to Ezra, what with hating him prior to the incident, Ezra attacking him, and his role as a religious man, which may give him a righteous motivation for bringing Ezra to some kind of justice. In addition, he did not believe in cremation, meaning the justice he may have taken it upon himself to dole out could have had more religious context. However, he was found beaten and with strangulation marks on his throat from the cord he claimed Ezra used. It would have been difficult for him to do much of anything after being subjected to that. That's without mentioning the doubt that he could subdue Ezra in the first place, regardless of the injuries he suffered. Ezra was a much younger and more physically fit person than the old, brittle priest. Additionally, there is no proof that the priest did anything at all. And besides, where would he find the means to turn Ezra to ash, especially in a neat little pile out behind his church? That brings us to the theory's implausibility. Let's start with the fact that there was ash, but there were no bones. Not even ground up and mixed in the ash. It takes very, very, very hot fire to disintegrate bones.
It takes lava.
It takes the sun. Cremation is done between 1,000 and 1,200 degrees Celsius. You need to burn a body at least 300 degrees hotter than that to start destroying bone. Prolonged exposure can destroy the bones at high temperatures, but that still has to be at extremely high temperatures, temperatures one simply cannot get here on Earth, even in a cremation oven. That makes it certain that no human would have been able to destroy Ezra's bones like that. What's also odd is that his necklace was completely untouched. At the temperatures needed to destroy a human being the way Ezra would have been destroyed, the fire would melt the silver necklace, as silver melts at 961.8 degrees Celsius. It was also perfectly clean, void of any scorch marks, so it must not have been particularly close to any fire. And yet, Ezra had been...
Fun fact about cremation. If you happen to have a pacemaker and the family does not inform the crematorium that your family member had a pacemaker and the crematorium was unable to check any medical records and somehow did not perform a physical check before putting the body into the cremator, the pacemaker explodes under the pressure, taking most of the body with it.
Fun. Thank you, Belle.
You're so welcome. A lot of medical devices do have to be removed before you are cremated. The family gets the option to keep them.
Oh.
Sometimes.
Okay. This is your public PSA, everybody. If you have a pacemaker, make sure your family knows for when you're dead.
Most family members do know about pacemakers. They kind of cause a disturbance in TSA.
And yet, Ezra had been seen wearing the necklace in the security camera footage on the western side when he walked down the street to approach the church. The priest also recalled that he was wearing it when strangling him because he saw the pendant dangling above him from Ezra's neck, and he felt that it was a message from God that he would survive.
That is not a message from God. If you were being actively strangled, I would not take that as a message from God that everything's going to be okay. You know, like, relax.
I don't know. If I was deeply religious and I was like, I'm going to die, and then suddenly I saw a cross above me as my vision was fading out, I'd be like, no, God's got me. Religion, man, does things to you.
I mean, in some cases, I would argue that in a church, you do have to have an ounce of common sense that maybe there might be some religious imagery around me as I die, if I'm going to die in the church.
This is possible. I also assume it's hard to think about a lot of logical things while you are running out of breath and your vision is fading out as you die.
It is, actually. Oxygen deprivation makes you dumb.
That's no good, yeah.
But I'm not calling the thought of, like, hey, God's here, dumb. That's actually a very comforting thought to many dying people. However, the thought of survival. Usually when people start to die, the psychology around dying is a piece of dying that is associated with religion of, like, God's got me, not God's gonna resurrect me.
Well, I think in this scenario, it wasn't, oh, God's gonna resurrect me from the dead. It's like, God's gonna step in, I'm not gonna die here. God's plan for me is not over, that kind of thing.
Oh, okay. Well, denial is the first stage of grief.
And yet he did live.
So true.
So maybe he was onto something.
Maybe he is clairvoyant.
Maybe heaven really did step in for him.
All of heaven all at once.
Simultaneously. Collectively. There were just seraphim everywhere.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Look at him go.
Oh my God. Oh my God. There's so many eyes and wings. They're like, be not afraid, but you are very afraid. Yeah.
Be not afraid.
Okay, whatever you say. And yet, Ezra must not have been wearing the necklace if he was set on fire, which, even if he was somehow cremated like that, would still leave us with more questions about how that was done and where his bones were. The question of when Ezra died is also up in the air. The ashes were found 15 hours after the priest's call to the police, so he died within that time frame. But there's no telling when.
No, he didn't.
Did he die before we saw him alive on the camera?
He didn't die at all. He died. He escaped.
Oh, is that your theory?
Yeah, obviously. He did not just turn into a pile of ash. He didn't just, ooh, I'm gonna wither away.
He jumped right back out that window he broke and parkoured across town and was like, ha, you'll never catch me. Let me leave my necklace here first, though, to confuse you all.
Well, if you want to escape a bunch of religious people that have religious connections throughout your country, yes, staging your death would probably be the best way. And if the people are willing to believe that someone just got ashed up, someone cremated him and then returned him,
who's to say? It's possible. Maybe he did.
Maybe. You know what? Maybe. But it's just, frankly, it's not something I think you would write. Because I feel like you'd be like, he was cremated and spread across each one of the ashes of the churches that he burned, unable to be found, mixed with the religious. You know?
It does sound like something I would write.
It is exactly something that you would write.
I'm such a sucker for symbolism.
Yeah, you would go spread the ashes along the church's axes, making them undistinguishable from one another, proving that all we are is matter.
Makes you wonder where God begins and man ends, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. That is something I would write. If one pokes back through this, in fact, you can find multiple biblical references just in the way I have phrased and written things. Yes, I have depression. Okay.
You read the Bible this year for your literature class.
I did. I love religious imagery because of my religious trauma, I think.
This is so true.
There's no telling when in those 15 hours he could have died, or how, or where. If his body, sans bones, was destroyed by fire, we must realize that no natural fire could have killed him right outside the church. Even the average house fire only burns up to 815 degrees Celsius. So then, what is plausible?
He ran away. He took some of the church's ashes from the churches that he literally burned, and then he ran away.
He kitten caboodled right out of that's not skadoodled.
It's also something that you would write where it's like he took ashes from each of the churches that he burned and then he returned to the place. He abandoned his last semblance of religious imagery after his sister went to prison and he fled.
It's beautiful.
It is. That's why you would write it.
Thank you. If his body was burned, he must have been in a cremation oven. It was the only way to turn his body completely to ash like that. It wasn't something the church possessed, obviously. The bones would still have been extant, though, meaning that if Ezra was ash, his bones were elsewhere. There was, as stated, no trace of bone in the pile, so again, there was no way to confirm the ashes for him aside from the necklace's implication.
Okay, I'm gonna step in here.
No.
I'm talking about cremation. I'm talking about cremation. I'm making this point valid.
All right, fine.
Crematories that do anonymous cremation for unclaimed bodies, which is a really sad concept, where if hospitals have unclaimed bodies, if the bodies do not get claimed, they are sent to a crematorium where they burn them and they chop up their bones, but their bones sometimes combine and everyone gets a little bit of bone because it doesn't matter. They're unclaimed bodies. No one's going to come claim the ash either, and there's no way to tell at that point. So their bones are then all processed together, which would give some validity to your theory here, despite the fact that you're pushing for something that's silly.
Psychotic.
Yeah.
Yes. It's supposed to be psychotic. This whole cremation thing is, I'm trying to emphasize that it's psychotic.
It is. It is. But
I get more clear to that, but
Here's your validity to it is that his bones could be mushed together in someone else's bone dust pile, in which the bone dust pile, you're not going to get DNA from that. There's no way. You would get so many different strands, there'd be no way to tell.
Well, what crematorium would take some rando who murders him, dragging him in, being like, hey, can you cremate this rando so that I can go drop him out back of a church? So, but we're getting to that part of the psychoticness of the theory.
Well, oh my God. All you'd have to do is put him on a gurney and tie a tag to his foot, put him in the hospital on the next way out.
Well, sure, maybe that's what happened. Who's to say?
I'm not saying it's realistic. You're trying to claim that he got cremated in return.
I'm trying to talk about what the police were so stuck on. Because the police were stuck. But you won't let me get there. You keep being like, this is a stupid theory. And I'm like, yeah. And you're like, I can't believe you're trying to push this. And I'm like, you don't understand. The police were. Let me get there.
The police were. You said as you wrote it down.
Yes, I wrote that the police were psychotic. I feel like there's a bajillion, like, real true crime stories where the whole problem is the police were literally stupid. This is a case where the police were literally stupid.
Oh, yeah, that's fair. I don't watch true crime because it makes me uncomfortable.
I used to listen to true crime, and I felt like 9 times out of 10, the police were just horrible at their jobs, and that's part of what is playing into all of this.
I listened to one true crime case, and it was very, very odd. And I saw videos of a murderer walking around with a dead body, so that was really cool.
If this was true, someone had to have access to a cremation oven in the middle of the night. No break-ins had been reported, so if someone had put him in an oven, it was likely that they had a key to the building and a means to get Ezra in. He didn't exactly have enemies in the cremation business, though, which does make this more difficult. Granted, perhaps someone knew what he'd been doing and going to the churches and had a religious objection to it. Perhaps a scuffle had happened and they wanted to get rid of the evidence. But that scenario begs the question of why anyone would transport the ashes back to the church, an active crime scene, and pour them in a neat little pile with his necklace on it. The closest crematorium was miles away. It simply doesn't add up, especially because someone would have had to have lugged Ezra across the town to a crematorium to destroy him. However, investigators spent a long time looking into the theory anyway, which baffled many outsiders who were following the case. Like Belle.
Yeah.
It seemed so clear that that was impossible. Why were they wasting their time on what many regarded to be an obvious wild goose chase? Another, more likely solution could be that the ashes were from something else entirely. Something large enough to leave a...
What if someone else had cremated someone?
Do you mean, like, if they cremated somebody else and they put them in a pile?
What if you took Grandma out?
Yeah.
What if you took her out and you poured her behind the church and you just took a gold necklace and put it on top?
You've cracked the case.
I have.
Something large enough to leave a cremated Ezra-sized pile, and it was done as a symbol, likely for what he'd been doing to the churches. That means something else had to have happened to Ezra's body if he was killed, but investigators, after they finally moved away from the burning theory, couldn't find anything else pointing to what had happened to Ezra, likely because they had wasted so much time with this case. There was no trace of him aside from that necklace. Means was a dead end for the investigators, so they tried to look at motive to discover what happened to him. Esther was in prison, so she could not have done something to Ezra, and she had no reason to anyway. His parents hated him, but they too were dead, and most other family members didn't live anywhere near the incident and had alibis. They didn't even have any evidence that someone who knew him would want to get rid of him. Eventually, investigators did admit that they believed the ash pile was symbolic due to his burning of churches, and he was killed somewhere else by other means, simply without a trace. This disgruntled many who couldn't see why the police had been so incompetent from the start.
Like me.
No matter what the cause, Ezra Strasser was gone, and he was never seen again, aside from a silver cross. That's all for today. Thanks for listening. Send in your thoughts, theories, questions, and comments to untruecrimethepodcast@gmail.com, all lowercase, for a chance to be featured at the end of the season during our Q&A. Bye!
Bye!